Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I am Gary Gramlin. He is Andy Benoit. And we have reached the penultimate show in our preseason position rankings. Today's going to be edge rushers. Or I should say edge players, because there's more to edge rushers than just rushing the passer. You got to stop the run. You got
that's a very narrow view of it, Gary. A very limited perspective.
That was I got to open my mind a little bit. So we'll say edge players, we will call them. We'll be talking about the Von Millers and Khalil Max and whatnot, and ranking the top 15 in the league according to our scientific and definitive poll. But before we jump into that, Andy, we actually have some housekeeping here. Stuff happened for a long time this offseason. Stuff didn't happen, but stuff has happened. So let's run down what went down in the past week here, and we'll start with the guys who got some monster contract extensions here. And we're going to skip Von Miller. We'll get to him when we discuss Von Miller during the rankings. But Mo Wilkerson got paid, which was pretty stunning.
Yeah, I don't think anybody saw that coming. It's not stunning that you would re-sign a guy like that. Stunning that it was him because of all the headbutting that had been going on there. I'm not surprised in the bigger picture because, as you know, Gary, I think Muhammad Wilkerson is – he's in the J.J. Watt class. Now, he's the bottom of that class, and it might just be him and Watt. He's not really close to Watt, but he's at the very top elite level. And I think there are certain guys you can't let get away – regardless of whether you theoretically have replacements for him, like a Leonard Williams, that's why you draft players. Is you draft them ultimately with the hope, especially first rounders, with the hope that they might become as good as Muhammad Wilkerson has become.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it was totally out of left field, and it really seemed like a foregone conclusion that he was not going to have a long-term future with the Jets, but looks like he does, which is good. I was kind of bummed when he got injured in the finale last year, because it kind of looked like the sort of confluence of events was going to sort of conspire into him never getting paid.
Him, yeah.
Yep.
And he's our buddy because he did our MMQB up front 2 years ago. I remember how little Peter King looked sitting on stage in front of the advertisers next to Muhammad Wilkerson.
They should have done like a ventriloquist act where Peter sits on Muhammad Wilkerson's lap. Maybe next year. Maybe that will get the advertisers in here.
I don't think he needs to show up next year, if you get what I mean.
Justin Tucker, who made some, I don't know, I think pretty awesome threats. Justin Tucker seems to really have it together. He is probably the best kicker in football. I think I'd elevate him ever so slightly over Gostkowski based on the Gostkowski miss in Denver, missed extra point. I think Tucker might have been a smidge better than him anyway. He hit so many big kicks, and he hit so many long kicks. I mean, so many 50-plus game winners. But he had basically told the Ravens, if I play under the franchise tag this year, I'm not going to play for you after this year. So the Ravens ponied up and got it done. $10.8 million guaranteed for Justin Tucker. I know you love kickers, so you must have been excited about this.
I respect kickers. I just don't know anything about them. And I don't think head coaches know. John Harbaugh would, because he was a special teams coach for a long time. But he might be the only head coach who actually knows anything that goes into the art of kicking.
Yeah.
So here's what I do know, though, is when you have – there's two things in the kicking game that can really impact an offense and a defense and actually the way you call a game if you're a coach. That is if you have a kicker with range, like big-time range like Tucker has, and if you've got a punter who is very good at ball placement. That expands field for you. You have more field position to work with, more options there. So guys like Justin Tucker – they're valuable not just because they don't miss very often, but because of the kicks you're comfortable asking them to attempt.
Yep. And Justin Tucker, by the way, also an opera singer.
Is he now?
So now you know something about a kicker.
Well, that'll help him fit into the locker room, I'm sure, because
exactly.
that's always the issue with kickers, as you know.
That's the culture in the Ravens locker room.
Terrell Suggs is a big fan of it, I'm sure.
Guy we've talked about a little bit this offseason, a couple times, I feel like, David Amerson. Got an extension sort of out of nowhere, 4 years, $38 million, 18 of that guaranteed. And that's a nice story. I don't know if he's a good dude or not. I really don't know anything about him aside from the fact that he hadn't been very good in Washington, and he showed up in Oakland and was really good last year.
Yeah, I kind of felt vindicated for our show because we have talked about that, and nobody else says anything because he's David Amerson, and who is that for a lot of people? So apparently the Raiders thought he was very good as well. I was glad to see him get paid just because it felt like a pat on the back for you and me. Now we'll see how good he is now that he has been paid, because he even said – his issues at previous stops a little bit pertain to maturity. And you always wonder how much more mature a guy becomes when you give him millions of dollars.
Yep. And we had four guys who will play under the tag this year, did not work out a long-term contract. That would be Kirk Cousins in Washington. Do you think Cousins is just a guy? I know you have a ton of respect for what they do schematically in Washington. Do you think Cousins is replaceable at this point? Let's say he has a similar season and you know, they bring in someone new next year.
I can't wait to see how this season plays out with Cousins, because I don't know the answer to that question. If you'd asked me that question a few months ago, I probably would have said he's just a guy if I had to pick one. You hate to say that about somebody, but yeah. I know what you're asking there.
Yeah.
But I spent some time at Washington's camp a few weeks ago, and I watched Kirk Cousins' practice film with Sean McVay in his office, and McVay has never BS'd me about a player. He's always been very upfront and honest with me when he and I are just talking, and he loves Kirk Cousins. He thinks the world of him. He had points to make, and he showed me film where he was evidencing the points. So I don't know the answer to that, because Cousins has played in a well-designed offense, and it hasn't asked him to make a lot of plays yet. Does the offense expand where they do start asking him to make more plays? This is the year we're going to learn about Kirk Cousins, and it makes all the sense in the world that he's still franchise tagged, because I don't know if Washington, the coaches might like him, but Scott McLuhan's the guy that ultimately makes the decision, him and probably Bruce Allen in the front office. I don't know if they know the answer to your question yet, Gary.
Yep.
I'll say this. Everyone who's met Kirk Cousins or has said, oh, you're going to meet Kirk Cousins, you'll like him. And I almost didn't want to meet him at camp, because I thought, what if I still think he's just a guy? Like, that just becomes more complicated. And, of course, of all the guys I've met, and it would never really impact your analysis, but of all the guys I met, he's the only one who said, well, hey, it's nice meeting you. I'll have to check out your work and follow you this year.
Man, I hope he's not listening to this where I asked if he was just a guy. Now I feel bad.
And I kind of didn't say no. I know. But we'll find out about him. I think both sides are in the right spot here. Washington's playing it safe. Cousins, he didn't really have a choice in the matter, but he gets paid $20 million to bet on himself this year in a scheme that fits him perfectly.
Yep. Alshon Jeffrey, not extended. I should say tagged, but not extended. So he'll play on a one-year deal here, and it seems like this will be his last year in Chicago. It would seem to be a durability issue. They don't really trust him to stay on the field. They also have Kevin White coming back this year, their first-round pick of 2015. So they have a little bit more depth at receiver this year. But were you surprised they didn't make a commitment to Alshon Jeffrey?
No, I think it was a durability issue. If he has... Well, he was healthy in 2013 and 2014. So it was his rookie year and then this past season with the injuries. And they were the type of injuries that kind of concern you, the hamstringy, the soft tissue type stuff, I believe. So if he has that kind of season like he had in 2014 this year, or even 2013 where he's 1,400 yards, which he's capable of, I would think they'll sign him long term. Yeah. I don't think Kevin White's here to replace Jeffrey. I think White was drafted to replace Brandon Marshall.
Nope. And Tremaine Johnson, tagged out in L.A., sort of a surprise tag guy. When you saw the franchise tag names come out, it was kind of like, oh, Tremaine Johnson, interesting. He was not on our top 15 cornerback countdown, although we did discuss him in a subsequent mailbag, and we sort of said he was decent.
He was considered for that, certainly. He's a good player. He's very good in off coverage. And when you're good enough, and he can play more than just, that's the difference, I think, with him and Jenkins. He can play more than just off coverage.
Yep.
Jenkins, Janoris Jenkins, who they let him walk and they re-signed Tremaine Johnson. I think Jenkins was a little more unrefined, a little less refined in man-to-man. But why off coverage is important in that situation? Because their pass rush is so good in Los Angeles. Yeah. You want guys that can jump routes to amplify the pass rush. That's the whole point of it. That's by the way, why Jenkins, we've talked about, went to the Giants with Olivier Vernon. They're working pass rusher with off coverage cornerback there in New York as well.
Yep.
I like Tremaine Johnson quite a bit.
All right. So that's good news. And then finally, we have Eric Berry. I was kind of surprised that the Chiefs and Berry did not come to an agreement, A, because you had this sort of heartwarming storyline of his return, and he's certainly a fan favorite out in KC. And on top of that, you had the Harrison Smith deal, which you would think pretty much provided a blueprint.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Safeties, there have been some other safeties this offseason. George Iloka is the one that comes to mind, where there was some trouble determining their value. And who, where do they rank at the top of the market in relation? I believe Earl Thomas is still the highest paid. Maybe did Harrison Smith surpass Earl Thomas now as highest paid?
Yes, yeah, Smith edged ahead of Earl Thomas with the deal he signed this offseason, $250,000. Yeah.
So, yeah, the market has been set then. I don't know what's going into the Barry discussions. I can't answer that. That is the only peculiar one of these remaining franchise tags to me, and I'm sure there's an explanation for it. We'd be guessing at it.
Yeah. Other news across the league here. Arian Foster signs with the Miami Dolphins. 1 year, $1.5 million. Going to play in that Adam Gase system. A little bit curious just because they spent a third-round pick on Kenyon Drake, who figures to be their passing back. They're, you know, their third down guy, sort of complimenting Jay Ajayi.
Yeah, Ajayi, and I like Drake with Ajayi in theory because they're, as you kind of hinted, their skills complement one another. Ajayi's more of a between the tackles runner, and Drake is the flexible guy. So I don't know where Foster fits in. He's an interesting blend of both guys, actually, if he's healthy, and that's of course going to be his caveat for the rest of his life. Arian Foster, if he's healthy. It's worth the risk, though, I would think. It's a small contract. Doesn't hurt to have a veteran presence there when you have so many young backs as well. And you know what, Gary? There's one other guy that nobody talks about, but he's always impressed me. And I don't know why he doesn't play more, because he's extremely good in the passing game. And that's Damian Williams. Yeah. He's their return guy. He's their, an undrafted guy in 2014. I don't know where he fits in, but I would like to see him get more opportunities.
I mean, I would have to think he's squeezed out at this point. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I didn't think they had a really room for a third back in that rotation. You know, obviously they're not paying Foster big money, but
yeah, I don't know. With Landry being the punt returner, kick returners, which is where Williams was a difference maker a few years ago, they're not as valuable now because of all the touchbacks that you see.
Yep.
So maybe someone's getting squeezed out. They're not well. They could maybe go with four running backs here because they don't carry. They might not carry a fullback. Whatever it is, I like the move for Foster because all these other guys we're talking about, they're young, unproven players.
And just a quick note on the kick returner bit. With the touchbacks moving out to the 25, kick returners might have a little boost in value now because a lot of teams are basically setting it up so that they're going to pooch kicks inside the five.
Yep, the NFL got that one backwards, I think.
Yeah, yes, they did. I mean, you could look at college
see. Yeah, we'll find out.
You know, that was one thing. Roberto Aguayo, the second round pick of the Bucks, when he was at Florida State, everyone was sort of wringing their hands over his average kickoff distance. And Jimbo Fisher basically said, well, yeah, we had him pooch all the kicks. You want him to kick it out of the back of the end zone, he'll kick it out of the back of the end zone. But we wanted him to pin guys inside the five and we go cover the kicks. So I think there's going to be a lot of that this year with the extra 5 yards of field position. And a couple of suspensions here. Aaron Lynch, Carlos Williams. Lynch, of course, the bright young pass rusher for the 49ers. Talented guy on a team that's a little bit short on talent. I don't know. The Niners don't figure to be a big player in the NFC West this year. You would think anything can happen once the season starts, but they can't really do much in the pass rush without Lynch in there, I would think.
Probably not. It depends if Ahmad Brooks bounces back and becomes what he was prior to last season. He had a bad season last year. He's only 32, which isn't young, of course, but that's not the age that you would wash up at necessarily. If he can play better, they can probably survive the Lynch absence for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But they have other young guys. Eli Harold and Corey LeMonnier, those are younger, unproven pass rushers still, or not unproven so much as they are unrefined. And the Niners like their rotation of guys, I know. I've actually spoken with their linebacker coaches, and they like what they have there.
Okay.
But what they have there still needs some polish. And I would put Aaron Lynch in that discussion as well, and getting suspended isn't the best first step for becoming more polished.
Yep. And Carlos Williams out in Buffalo. And look, he was a guy who had some character red flags coming to the draft last year. Big size speed guy, had a really good rookie year with the Bills. He has some passing game skills that would sort of surprise you too, but he will sit the first four games. LeSean McCoy, unlike last year, enters the season fully healthy, you would assume. And on top of that, they are losing Jonathan Williams. Well, they haven't officially lost Jonathan Williams, but rookie Jonathan Williams, their fifth rounder, running back out of Arkansas, popped for DUI. So not a good week for the Bills.
No, and they used a few more two-back sets last year, two running backs with Carlos Williams and LeSean McCoy, and they were pretty good out of that. And one of the teams they used those two-back sets against was New England, who they play in week four. So I'm sure they were not at all thrilled that Carlos Williams got himself suspended.
Yep. Well, Andy, we're going to take a quick 30-second break, and then we are going to get in to the aforementioned edge player countdown. NFL training camps open in 2 short weeks, and we're all fired up for another year. That's true for the MMQB, as well as our colleagues over at the Audible's NFL podcast. SI senior writer Don Banks and host Andrew Perloff are delivering football insight and a lot of laughs. Their Buddy Ryan tribute episode was especially well done. You can find Audible's NFL podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or on si.com/podcasts. A couple of friends of the MMQB there, Don Banks and Andrew Perloff. Good dudes.
Yes, sir.
Good show. Good show as well. All right, Andy, we're going to do one quick mailbag question. But before that, I actually wanted to read something very quickly. Every week, I beg and plead for everyone to please go to iTunes and leave reviews, preferably good reviews. It helps get our show out there and helps promote us a little bit. Some of you done that. Greatly appreciated. Most of them have been positive. Even more appreciated. But one dude writes in here, this is Tom2226, enjoy the podcast, the two have really good chemistry, et cetera, et cetera. The one guy is really smart, and I learn a lot. I'm assuming he's talking about me. And Well, if he said also handsome, then he'd be talking about me. So I guess you could go, you could go either way with that one. But the last line of this review here is, I also like when they rip the producer for dumb position rankings.
Oh, okay. Well, good. And he better like that, because we wind up having to do it every week. And I saw Jeff Irwin's edge ranking list here, and he put together an outline for us as well. And so in the outline, he conveniently weaved in all of his excuses for some of his horse crap rankings that he has again here this week. So there's only quarterbacks left for Jeff Irwin to obliterate on our rankings. And I'm particularly unimpressed with how obliterating his list was to our edge players this week.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And I always take this opportunity to say we love Jeff Irwin. We still love Jeff Irwin, despite the many times suspect rankings he sends in.
Yeah.
But, we do hear a lot about that. And we will, I don't know, maybe on social media or something after next week's show, which will be the finale, we'll roll out everyone's individual rankings so you can get upset with each of us individually.
Oh, good.
But we do have one mailbag question here. Brian Thomitz wrote in to TalkBack, asked which cornerbacks provide the best run support in football. I would say off the top of my head, the two guys, Peanut Tillman, who just officially retired, he would be the sort of, Hall of Famer. Not literally Hall of Famer, but he'd be the Hall of Fame caliber run support guy. Yeah. David Amerson's a guy who sticks out to me. That's why I actually always thought Amerson would end up at safety sooner rather than later. And I know the Patriots aren't a lot, so I see them more than most teams, but I think Logan Ryan does a really nice job in run support out there.
Okay. I'm not going to give specific names. That'd be a lot to go through. I'd rather give a concept here.
Okay.
Teams that play two high safeties that keep both safeties back, and the two best examples would be the Bengals and the Vikings at times play two safeties back quite a bit. The Bills as well. Those teams tend to rely more on their corners and run support, because if both safeties are back, then the corner is likely to have the furthest outside contain responsibility on the edge. And that's always going to be true with cover two coverage. So teams that play cover two need to have good tackling corners. Now, a lot of times if you're playing cover two, then you're probably playing cover three with only with a safety down in the box on first or second down. But the point is, two high safeties, cover two especially, you need good corners. And I think without question, the team that has the best collective tackling cornerback group is the Minnesota Vikings. And not coincidentally, they have a longtime defensive backs guru coach and Mike Zimmer who teaches them. Another team that has a good group for it, they're more hitters than they are tacklers. But the Los Angeles Rams cornerbacking group's pretty good as well. And okay, that's part of the reason I think people don't like playing against them, because some of those corners have been nasty hitters. And I don't think they're dirty at all. I think they're a hard-hitting group.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, LaMarcus Joyner got some heat for who'd he injure?
Yeah, it was, I think it was Bridgewater on a scramble
right.
play.
Yep.
And it was a close call. But yeah, it was a hell of a hit too, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I didn't feel that was dirty. I thought it was unwise, reckless.
Yeah, reckless. A lot of times it's reckless more yeah. than dirty. You don't see a lot of purely dirty plays in the NFL.
Yeah.
Not anymore. Guys are all too rich. They all share agents. It's
yep.
It's a nice guy's league. It's a nice guy's league.
There you go. Well, as always, if you have a question for us, reach out on Twitter, Andy_Benoit, ggramling_si, or you can get us on Facebook, or you can write into talkback@themmqb.com. And if you put podcast in the subject line, it improves the odds that it will be seen by a human. Andy, it is time for this week's position ranking, edge players. If you haven't heard any of the previous shows, we've done almost every position. This will be everything but quarterbacks at this point. If you want to listen to any of the old ones, you know, you can get us on iTunes or SoundCloud or Stitcher. They're all there. Now, oh, I guess I have to run through the rules here. AP poll style. So Andy, myself, and Jeff Irwin, our researcher, rank our top 15, 15 to 1. You get a first place vote, you get 15 points. You get a last place vote, you get 1 point. And Andy's votes count as double because he's that smart. I'm going to start by running through the guys who fell outside of our top 15 this week. We had Robert Ayers, Elvis Dumervil, Tamba Ali, Jason Pierre-Paul, Brandon Graham, Alden Smith, Carlos Dunlap, William Hayes, Whitney Merciless, and James Harrison were the others.
Was that you? Was that you on Harrison? I see he got 1 point. So someone put him at number 15.
I did not. I actually had Harrison at 16. Irwin had him at 15. I like that Harrison doesn't run support now.
Yeah. Well, he's a very good backup outside linebacker at this point in his career. He's actually a fine player. He's not – I didn't consider him at all, though.
Yeah.
I didn't consider any Steelers at all for this list.
They don't have a very good group of outside linebackers now, which is why they had to bring back James Harrison.
Bud Dupree was intriguing at times last year, so we'll see what they have with him. And that's, as we've talked about before, it's not an easy scheme to play in, and the fact that he was on the field as a rookie – is encouraging. It looks like Jarvis Jones isn't going to become what they thought.
Yeah.
Which tells you the draft's a total crapshoot again. Because remember, we think of the Steelers as such a smart front office and a stable organization, and they are. Remember how many stories there were about all the rejoicing they did when they realized Jones was going to fall to them in the draft?
Yep.
And then it turns out to be a bust. The draft's a crapshoot.
It is.
And
it
that's
is.
A well-coached team, too. So a lot of times when guys are busts, you have to look at the coaching, which nobody does.
Yeah.
But that's not the case in Pittsburgh either. So Jones himself has got a lot more to live up to.
Well, I always wonder about that, you know, the Georgia edge guys. I think they get a nice boost from the scheme they run out there. A couple of big names. JPP was a guy I thought belonged on the list. I thought, all things considered, last year he was pretty good considering he was playing with one hand, and I think he'll be even better in his second year back this year. But I don't have a, I don't know.
I think this will be the telling year with JPP. I saw flashes of him.
Yeah.
He was much better when he was attacking inside than outside, and I don't know if that has something to do with the grip or not. They don't know what they have in him quite yet either, though, and I think that's why they gave him a one-year deal. So they tell you tacitly there they don't know what they have.
Yeah.
We all are rooting for him, of course.
Yep. Well, let's go to the guys who did make the top 15 here. Again, we had a tie for 15th. Between newest Arizona Cardinal Chandler Jones and Chicago Bear Pernell McPhee. Now, Jones is an interesting guy. He is in a contract year here, which is why the Patriots presumably moved on from him for what was not the same type of return. They got a second-round pick, and they got an interesting lineman in Jonathan Cooper, but certainly not the value you'd expect to get if you had Jones locked up for more than a year. He's kind of, you know, physically he's pretty incredible, tremendous length. He's very flexible. I believe you would say lithe I think we've had this conversation before.
No, the word that I use is, and you always won't let me, and you editors take it out, is, don't I say willowy?
Willow. You do say willowy, and we do
which
not
I
let
think
you
of
have
as
that.
Long-armed. That's what I think. But I guess it means, like, long-armed if you're a female in a long dress from the 1930s or something like that. You explained to me it was an antiquated term, and even then it was incorrect.
It is. It's more for, you know, I think there are certain receivers you could call willowy, guys who look out there and just think, man, that dude is skinny. He is
what?
Skinny.
Well,
and
in that case, I could. You ought to let me call Chandler Jones willowy because it's within the context of their position. He's a skinny defensive end. If he were a receiver, yeah, he'd be a fatter one.
He has some broad shoulders, though.
The willowy issue hasn't been a verbiage issue. It's been an interpretation of body types thing with you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. No, when you're willowy, like, you know, you're sort of compact up top and you're skinny and you're, you know, you're just a rail. That's what willowy means. And it does have the connotation is a little bit effeminate. So
tall,
on top
slim,
of that,
and lithe is the definition of it. And then I've Google imaged it, and yeah, it's a lot of women on this. Yeah. So no Chandler Jones in these, at least not on the first page of Google images here.
No, the guy I said, and I think I've actually mentioned this specifically to you, and I don't mean to pick on the guy, but I always think of Todd Pinkston. If I was going to call anyone willowy, I was thinking back to Todd Pinkston because he always had those like super skinny arms, but then like the giant shoulder pads sort of make up for the fact that he wasn't the biggest guy out there.
When I was 18, I learned what the word gossamer means, which I guess is like spider webby like really frail and delicate.
Yeah.
And I used it on Todd Pinkston in my Eagles preview that year.
Whoa.
Poor Todd. I said he had a gossamer frame, and then look how smart I was.
There you go. I would let that stand if you put it in a piece about Todd Pinkston. But anyways, Chandler Jones, I mean, he's the kind of guy they need in Arizona. They ran Dwight Freeney out there last year, and you know, they're desperate for that edge help.
I'm curious to see how they're going to use him. I'm not convinced he will be an edge rusher for them.
Yeah.
They might start out that way, but I think Jones is at his best as a down lineman, as like a five technique or he could probably play three technique between the guard and tackles at times, but head up aligned over the lineman, not out wide, because for all his talents, he's not an edge burner. He's not big time fast. Dwight Freeney is a better pure edge rusher than Chandler Jones is. Jones at this point is the far more complete football player, but Arizona does so many different things with their defensive fronts, moving guys around to get them mismatched, and Calais Campbell's always been the beneficiary of that. I could see Jones assuming more of a Calais Campbell type of role with them. They don't have a lot of other pass rushers, so they'll probably give him every opportunity to be an outside linebacker. I don't think he quite fits the scheme, though, is what I'm saying.
Okay. All right. That'll be interesting to watch.
And have you seen our outline here, Gary? Because Irwin has written in the outline the first Irwin bomb.
Yes.
Which means he's thinking Pernell McPhee is a bomb. I have no problem whatsoever with Pernell McPhee being on the list.
Yeah. Yeah, he only got a vote from Irwin. Irwin had him 7th, which propelled him into 15th here. Andy and I didn't rank him.
7th's a bit high. 7th's a bit high, but I like McPhee. He can play defensive. He's actually at his best as he's not a true D tackle, but he's at his best operating inside, like as a stand-up blitzer up the middle or something. He stood out a lot last year in Chicago, though. I think there's a lot to like about Pernell McPhee.
Yeah, and Irwin mentions ranked 9th among edge rushers by Pro Football Focus and led the league
in their
signature pass rush productivity stat. So Jones and McPhee tied for 15th. In 13th, we had Cameron Jordan and Jabal Sheard, a couple of guys with connections to Cleveland, former Cleveland guys, right? Jordan starting. No, I'm thinking of the tight end now.
You're thinking of Jordan Cameron. Jordan Cameron. Which would be an awful mistake because we're talking about like a black D lineman and a white tight end and how can you confuse the two gentlemen. But on draft day, if you recall, I think either the Browns called the wrong one or the Saints called the wrong one, too.
Is that right?
Everybody's been doing that. Yeah, everyone's been, even the teams themselves. I don't know anybody who follows football and hasn't mixed up Cameron Jordan and Jordan Cameron.
Well, I did it right there, and I knew we were talking edge rushers, and I was still thinking the tight end when I saw that name.
The tight end sometimes has to block the edge rusher, depending on the front, if you do a good job with your alignment.
There you go.
As a defense.
There's my justification.
Irwin, okay, so, oh, goodness. Jeff Irwin had Jabal Sheard number 5.
Yeah. I mean, that's on the high side.
if we're talking strictly inline run defense, meaning you contact the offensive tackle and then you work laterally down the line of scrimmage or from the backside, then I could maybe go with Jabal Sheard as a top five defensive end. Any other aspect of the game, though, he's a good player, but he's not top five. He's not top 15 in my estimation. You had him 17. I like Jabal Sheard. This is the problem with Irwin. He puts these good players in positions like they're Hall of Famers, and now we have to rip the good players.
I think everyone's great, so I don't rip anyone.
Yeah, coward. You coward. I'll tell you the other thing with Cameron Jordan real quick, and then we can move on to number 12, and that'll be one of my bombs, it looks like. I don't think Jordan's a true edge rusher either. I think he has to be not schemed necessarily, where you have to help him with stunts and twists and have good players around him. But he's more of a mechanical guy. He's going to beat you with his technique, not his explosiveness off the edge. Now, that's fine. It's worked for him. He's a productive player. But the explosiveness is usually the difference-making trait that teams have. And it goes back to the Chandler Jones thing a little bit too, where Jones has the stats of an explosive edge rusher, but the Patriots know he's really not an explosive edge rusher.
Yeah.
His sacks come from other means. When you pay an edge player big-time money, it's because he can get off the ball and bend the corner explosively. So if you can't do that, you're in that second tier to me.
Yeah. Now, he's a polarizing guy. I feel like a lot of people really like Cameron Jordan, and I feel like there are people who have said, you know, he had one breakout year. I want to say it was 2013, though I don't have his stats right up in front of me.
Peter likes him. Peter King's gotten this guy rich, I think.
Yeah.
Well, he gave him a lot of publicity. I think it was our first year. You're right. It was 2013. He had 12 and a half sacks.
Yep.
He had 10 sacks last year, though. And I know some, like Jeff Schwartz for the Giants blocked him. I mean, Schwartz was injured in this game, but Schwartz said he was the best player he faced all year long. And Schwartz is a pretty analytical guy. So, yeah, you're right. He is polarizing. He has a very specific skill set, and it's tied to his mechanics. And if he can win with that, then he's going to have a great game. If it's not enough, if he's going against probably, I would guess, an elite tackle, then I'm not sure he has the tools to be the guy you need to headline a pass rush.
All right. Well, Cameron Jordan of the Saints and Jabal Sheard of the Patriots tied for 13th in our countdown. In 12th, we have Jerry Hughes, 10th spot for Andy, not ranked by me and Irwin. I had Hughes 19th, so just off my list. So Irwin, calling this an Andy bomb.
I think Jerry Hughes has the best redirect inside pass rush move in the NFL. So start going outside upfield and then cut back inside and try to cross the face of the offensive tackle. I don't think anyone in the league does that as swiftly and congruently as Jerry Hughes. I like him a lot. Now, he only had 5 sacks last season. I know his career high is 10, but he's one of those, and this is rare with a guy who was a first-round bust for Indianapolis or a guy that didn't start out well and then has gotten better in the second half of his career. He's better than his stats indicate, though.
Yeah. You know, why was he able to turn around when he got out of Indy? Because he was a bust. He couldn't get on the field.
That's one of those. And remember last week we asked people who has gotten injured or missed the prime years of their career and then come back and had a very good second half of their career, maybe even a better second half. And some people, we got a few responses on that. I think someone said Dominique Wilkins. But another question I'd love to ask is, who has been an utter bust at one destination, at one place, and then all of a sudden been what you expect when he joins another team?
Yeah.
Because Hughes didn't get put in a different scheme in Buffalo either. He went to Jim Schwartz's scheme, which was a 4-3 upfield rushing scheme, just like in Indianapolis, and all of a sudden he was productive there. I don't know what got into him. I asked him once, actually, on the podcast, I think in 2013. I don't remember what he said.
Well, we'll have to go back and find that and play the clip.
Oh, I'm sure it's still up there, yeah.
Yeah. So Jerry Hughes in 12th. In 11th, we have Everson Griffin, who for a long time, he was a, he was just a third down guy. He was just a pass rush guy for Minnesota. Is he holding up as an every down player in your mind?
Yeah, I think he's there. I would love to see him be used in a variety of ways. I think his versatility mixed with his athleticism. I thought that's what made him unique. But remember, he got a big contract before he had produced anything.
Yeah.
A few years ago. And the reason why is because of that versatility mixed with the athleticism. We haven't seen that as much in Minnesota's scheme under Zimmer because they've got a lot of depth. They do more with their linebackers and safeties to change the fronts, not necessarily their defensive end. I would like to see him used in a greater variety of ways. So if we're talking about just maximizing Everson Griffin and not worrying about the rest of the team.
Yeah. Well, he was 12th on your poll. He was 10th on mine. Irwin did not rank Everson Griffin. Now, in 10th, we have T-Sizzle, Terrell Suggs, 8th for you, 15th for me, comes in 10th on our poll. I think with Suggs, it was just a matter of, you know, where do you put him? He's, you know, 34 years old, coming off a ruptured Achilles. You know, what can you expect from him?
There are a handful of guys in the league who I've decided I'm not going to bet against them anymore. I'm going to wait and just be wrong 1 year and say they're good and then watch them wash up all of a sudden. Because Suggs is one of those guys, I thought a few years ago, he had the Achilles in 2012, wasn't it? He missed half the season then, came back in the second half of the season, if I recall. I thought he was going to be a wash-up guy back then. And if anything, he's gotten better since then. He was very strong. Where he's good, his knowledge of the game, I hear, is off the charts. And he plays like that. He plays like a very smart football player. But he is really good in traffic as an inline run defender. And he can still burn the edge or get around the edge. Not quite like he's not Khalil Mack, but he can still turn the corner. And one other thing, Gary, there are also a handful of guys in the league that coaches will tell you don't attack their side of the field if the design of the play leaves them unblocked.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime a defensive end is unblocked, it's going to be part of the offensive design because no team draws up a play to not block the defensive lineman unless they feel that they can confuse the defensive lineman with the play design. So you're trying to outthink them, give them like a read option thing or a fake handoff, a ghost reverse. You've got to try to beat the defensive end who's unblocked. You beat him with your design. There are certain teams in the league that will absolutely not do that against a few players, and Suggs is one of the guys that every team says we're not going to do that against. We're not going to throw smoke screens to his side if we can help it. We're not going to run reverses to his side. Read option we're going to be very reluctant to do because he is so smart, and if you leave him unblocked, he'll beat your design anyway.
That's a great note.
There, the other two guys who are like that, by the way, that off the top of my head is JPP when he's at his usual self or his best self, and then Justin Houston of the Chiefs.
Nice. Well, Terrell Suggs is in 10th, another vet coming in at 9. This is DeMarcus Ware. And this is another one. Andy, you gave him the 7th place vote. Jeff and I didn't rank him. I consider Ware to be a guy who really benefits from the supporting cast, or I should say the surrounding cast in Denver. I think you mentioned when we did the defensive lineman show that he really benefits playing alongside Derek Wolfe.
He does against the run because of, it helps. And Malik Jackson, he actually played alongside Malik Jackson.
I'm sorry, Malik Jackson,
year.
That's right.
Because Wolfe tends to play the other side, but it's the same principle.
Yeah.
DeMarcus Ware has benefited from the people around him his entire career, though. And the reason why, he's going to go to the Hall of Fame because he's a great edge rusher. Agreed?
Yes.
In Dallas, what they would do with him is put him on the weak side of the formation with a 3 technique over there. So what does that mean? He's opposite the tight end, so there's no tight end to help block him. And then if you put a 3 technique, a defensive tackle between the guard and offensive tackle, that means the offensive tackle can't help on that guy because he's got to block DeMarcus Ware one-on-one. You used your front alignments to create one-on-one matchups for him. Dallas, Wade Phillips, when he had Ware, he did that extremely well for him. So I think when you say guys are made better by the people around them, that doesn't necessarily impact edge players quite as much. Mm-hmm. Because no matter who's with them, you can get them one-on-one matchups just by where you align your other players. It doesn't matter if the 3 technique is Gerald McCoy or if he's just Gary Grambling in there trying to play. Someone still has to block him if he plays at that spot.
Now you got to bust on me like I'm Todd Pinkston here?
Yeah, or Todd Pinkston is your 3 technique. I don't. I'm not going to go low enough. You might not block Pinkston, but the other guys, if someone lines up, whoever's along the defensive line, you've got to block them unless you're trying to beat them with the play design. And so it doesn't matter who's there. It doesn't matter who's around where. You can still get them one-on-one matchups.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's always capitalized on those. He was still – he wasn't healthy as much last season, but he was still very productive when he was in there.
Yeah. All right.
You don't agree? You sound surprised.
No, I mean, look, I left him out of it. I had him 23. I ranked way too many guys, and then I throw them all down there because I'm always afraid I'm going to forget anyone. So I basically wrote down every edge rusher who's ever played football on any level.
Yeah.
And then I cut it down to, I don't know, what I end up with, like 30 guys probably. But, yeah, I don't know, where is – he doesn't do it for me. I think if you plugged him into another defense – that didn't have so many other guys that have to preoccupy an offense on the other side of the ball. I don't know. I don't think he's nearly as productive. And I know you just made the whole point as to why that's not necessarily true, but you know, I didn't put him top 20, and I'll stand by that, Andy Benoit.
Okay. Well, you can always align where opposite the tight end, and then the tight end can go in motion and go to where's side, and there's not a thing the defense can do about it. So, and you're not going to send a tight end in motion away from Von Miller. So there's your side of the argument. And the Giants did that to Ware back in week one, I think 3 years ago, and had a lot of success. So I get it on both sides. I still like him as a player.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm fine with him as a player. I don't have a problem with him being top 10 on our list, but just not for me, Andy. Just not for me. So Ware comes in ninth. We have Cliff Avril coming in eighth. And he was a guy, he actually was top 11 for all of us. So nice bit of harmony here. 11th for you, 8th for me, and 6th for Irwin. Irwin poses an interesting question. Who's more important to the Seattle Seahawks, Cliff Avril or Michael Bennett?
I would say Bennett.
Yeah, I would too.
But that's not an easy one because Bennett, he tends to play on the same side as Avril in pass rushing situations. And that's to kind of piggyback off of the DeMarcus Ware point, that's what gets Avril the one-on-one blocking too. Avril's probably the best in the league at getting under an opponent's pads as a pass rusher. That's not to say he's a pure bull rusher because he's really more of a speed guy than bull guy, but mixing the two and going from speed to power and getting under the blocker's pads, Avril's as good as it gets. And that's quite scary when you consider that most quarterbacks are right-handed and he's coming off the right edge as well. He has a lot of forced fumbles because of that.
You know, I have a question for you that probably doesn't have a good answer, but I'm just going to ask it anyway because I've had this conversation before. Super Bowl 49, Avril got hurt, and a lot of people pointed to that as the turning point of that game. Now, I always thought the turning point was Jason Lane shattering his arm and tearing all the ligaments in his knee after that interception because that, you know, sent Thurald Simon into the game, and basically, any time he was one-on-one with Julian Edelman, it was a free completion for the Patriots on the little whip route that they run. And when you got to worry about Gronkowski, you can't really do anything about that defensively. So I thought Lane was the bigger loss in that game. I don't know. Do you you probably haven't watched that tape in at least a calendar year. But when you look back at the Super Bowl, who do you think was the bigger loss in that game? Lane going down or Avril going down?
Well, Jeremy Lane went down very early in the game, didn't he, relatively speaking? He went down on this interception in the end zone play, which was one of Tom Brady's worst plays as a pro, by the way.
By the way, did I just call him Jason Lane, like the old Astros outfielder? That was pretty lame.
Well, you may have said Jason Lane, but we all know you're talking Jeremy Lane.
I was thinking 2008 Major League Baseball, apparently.
And Jason Lane in baseball, I'm sure, was a tremendous guy and probably could have played nickelback in the NFL as well. I would say losing Avril in theory hurt more. What the difference in that game, though, is New England did a really good job of getting the matchups they wanted down the stretch with how they employed their receivers against the way Seattle was using its safeties. They shuffled guys around and got the matchups they wanted from that. But Avril, see, this is why guys like Avril are valuable. They offset that sort of thing. You can get a nice matchup, but if a guy gets beat right off the edge up front in your protection, it's not going to matter.
Yeah.
Did I even answer the question? I'll say Avril in the Super Bowl to answer it.
Well, now we're having an argument because you took the other side, and there's no gray area.
As you said, though, Jason Lane didn't even play in the Super Bowl. He's a baseball guy. So
Jason Lane, by the way, was a top prospect as a hitter, who then ended up being a pitcher. He was a pitcher/outfielder for a couple years for either the Phillies or the Astros.
Okay.
Which, you know, if we're going to do a list of pitcher/outfielders, maybe he makes that one. But they, you know, they throw him in as like a, you know, roster flexibility type of guy. He was an interesting guy. That's why I apparently think of him every once in a while, late at night when I close my eyes. So Averill comes in eighth. We have Ziggy Ansah coming in seventh. He was down a little bit last year. You had him five. I had him seven. Erwin didn't rank him, by the way. Ansah was a little bit down last year. I don't know if it had to do with the turnover they had on the interior line there. I don't know. What did you think of his play last year? Because he's a guy who really came on 2 years ago.
Yeah, he wasn't very good in the first half of last season, and he came to life in the second half. And so I cut him a break there because I think the skill set, the toolbox, is so extraordinary. His explosiveness, well, for his body type with that kind of length, long arms, and I'm not going to call him willowy because he is also very thick. There's not another guy in the league built like that who can move quite like that other than J.J. Watt. So, and they're different types of players, but yeah. I think you know what I'm saying.
Yep.
So I gave him the benefit of the doubt, and I have him five. I would love to play with Ziggy Ansah.
Yeah. All right, Andy, we're going to take a quick 30-second break, and we're going to come back with the top five. It's top six, but we had tie for fifth, so that's why we're cutting off here. And we're also going to have some of the responses to players who got injured and came back better than ever. This year's British Open was one for the history books. Henrik Stenson held off Phil Mickelson with a blistering 8-under-63 to win the first major of his career. Sean Zach and Jeff Ritter saw this amazing performance up close, and they have a full report from Scotland on this week's Golf.com podcast. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify. Just search for the Golf.com podcast or visit si.com/podcasts. All right, so last week when we were talking Thomas Davis, we had sort of mentioned that he had all those knee surgeries, and he came back better than ever, and he didn't change his game. He came back as athletic as ever, and you know it's just incredibly rare, and we sort of tried to brainstorm other guys across sports who have had major injuries or a series of major injuries and come back and not lost any athleticism.
Yeah, so, especially in the middle of their career.
Exactly.
Like Thomas Davis lost his three prime years according to his age.
Exactly. So we got a couple of responses here, and I will run through them now. Itamar Abidan on Twitter wrote in Russell Westbrook, three surgeries in the span of a year. I assume that's Russell Westbrook, right? Westbrook? I don't know what other Westbrook he would be referring to. Itamar admits not as severe as Davis, but still impressive. And he also mentioned Dominique Wilkins ruptured his Achilles and fractured his hand, but came back at an all-star level.
Okay. And the Westbrook run's a really good one because he's the most...
Yes.
He's the springiest player in the NBA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, he's lost nothing. This one was emailed to me by my friend and personal mentor, Mike Steiner from LA. Mike mentions Fred Taylor, which is... It's pretty good. Fred Taylor had... You know, he was... hurt a million times in the early and middle of his career. And I just remember he was a guy who stuck around for so much longer than you thought he would have stuck around.
Yeah, and that's a good one too. I'd say that's I would go with that one. Yeah.
All right.
He didn't ever have a major one. He may have had one or two, but he was just injury prone and then he all of a sudden wasn't injury prone.
Yeah. And we had Wesley Metcalf right in from East Yorkshire, UK. Rugby player. This is Johnny Wilkinson, greatest ever English rugby player. And he sent us this. This is an infographic from one of the papers out there. Let's see. Wilkinson played 91 times for England, won the World Cup in 2003. And he had this completely absurd list of injuries. Fractured right shoulder. Hematoma to upper right arm, appendix removed, groin strain and hernia, medial collateral ligament damage, twisted ankle, pulled hamstring, left knee injury, medial ligament damage to the other knee, torn abductor muscle, lacerated kidney. That's a pretty good one, lacerated kidney in 2006. Neck and shoulder operations in 2004.
All right, we get the point. He's a rugby guy, though.
There you go.
He's a rugby guy.
There you go. And he played until 2014. So that was a good one. I can't confirm or deny, but looking at that list and looking at his career accomplishments, I think that's legit. You know, I always say drop us a line. Andy and I are on Twitter, we're on Facebook, or send it to talkback@themmqb.com. But let's jump back into the countdown here. We have our top five. We had a tie for fifth between Robert Quinn and Olivier Vernon. And let's start with Vernon, because he's a really interesting case. You had him 9, I had him 6, Irwin had him 4. I mean, this is a guy who was all world for the second half of last season and was kind of, you know, decent before that.
No, I would disagree. I think he was much, much better than decent before
that.
You
think so?
Yeah, I think he's been really good for a lot of years.
I wonder if he... So he has a reputation, and I think it was because of a hit he had on Brady. He has a reputation. Guys think he goes low on quarterbacks intentionally. He sort of does the perfect on Roethlisberger thing a little too often.
Well, the irony of that is that, and maybe it's not ironic, what the Giants like most about him is that he naturally plays low to the ground.
Yeah.
That's his greatest strength. We talked about Averill as a leverage player under the pads. I maybe have to backtrack a little bit and say Vernon's actually the best all around, or Averill's the best leverage pass rusher. Vernon's the best all around leverage defensive end, though. He does play low to the ground, which is why he can be 260 pounds or whatever he weighs and still be a very good run defender on the play side. He does not get moved around at all for a guy who's undersized and light in the butt like he is.
So just addressing the second half of last year where, I mean, look, statistically, he blew up. I'm going to bring up his numbers right now.
I thought he was better in the first half, or not better, but I thought his numbers finally reflected his play.
Okay, that's what I was going to say.
I didn't think he just all of a sudden got hot.
Yeah, he had 5.5 sacks in, I guess, the last, like, 6 games of last year or something like that. So you think that was more in line with his talent and what you've seen from him before that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
That's fair enough. And I'll plead guilty to scouting the stat line a little too much on Olivier Vernon.
And then as far as Robert Quinn goes, he's just an incredibly fast, agile pass rusher. I don't think we need to say a whole lot more about Quinn. He's the most agile edge rusher in the NFL, just as an edge rusher. There's not a lot more to his game either, though.
And he was injured last year. I think he'd be top 4 if we did this a year ago. But Irwin left him out because of the back surgery, which, I don't know, if you're going to base it on the injury problems, you know.
Well,
those exist.
How does Irwin explain that he put Justin Houston at number 3? And I know we're going to do number 4 next, but not only is Irwin moronic on some of these, but he's inconsistent too, which is what makes it embarrassing.
We love Jeff Irwin, and I mean that legitimately. So we had Vernon and Quinn tied for 5th. Clay Matthews comes in 4th. A little bit of a unique case since he has been bouncing between inside linebacker and outside linebacker in Green Bay. He certainly seems to want to play the outside and back on the edge. And I mean, he's much better on the edge than he is inside. If you were the Packers, what do you do with him?
I think he's more, I wouldn't disagree with that assertion, but I would say he's more valuable to Green Bay inside.
Yeah.
And a lot of his, keep in mind, they do a ton of inside blitz concepts, fire X blitzes, fire zone blitzes. The zone blitz stuff that we knew from the Steelers for so many years. That's what Dom Capers was one of the godfathers of that, and he still does it as their D coordinator now in Green Bay. And Matthews was the ultimate piece for that. And so if you play him strictly on the edge, you lose that dimension. I don't think he'll play strictly on the edge. That would be a mistake. I think he's along with Byron Jones and Eric Weddle, Matthews was the most versatile defender in the NFL last season.
Yeah. So a bit of a different type of edge guy for this list, but Matthews comes in 4th. Andy had him 3, I had him 5. Irwin did not rank him. PFF, I guess, is really down on him with their grading. Again, he's a tough guy to peg. I mean, he plays a very unique role for the Packers. Coming in 3rd here, as Andy mentioned, Justin Houston. 6 on Andy's list, 3rd for me and for Irwin. Obviously, he is coming off the ACL, it seems like doubtful for week 1, probably going to miss the first month or so, you would think. When he's healthy, though, Andy, I really like him against the run, and obviously as a pass rusher. When he's healthy, do you put him in the same class as the top 2 guys on our list who you can probably guess at this point?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's I would, yes, because I think he is a very good run defender as well, play side and backside. Remember we said you don't block, you don't leave Suggs unblocked?
Yep.
Houston's another guy you don't leave unblocked. Even if the ball's going away from him, you don't want to leave him unblocked.
Yep.
He's sensational. And it's weird, but you wouldn't think, well, how good is a guy when he's unblocked? What does that indicate? That's usually a major indication of pure athleticism, because again, no team's going to leave a guy unblocked up front unless the design of the play is to exploit that guy being unblocked. So when you make the play as an unblocked defensive end, it usually means you've got better athleticism and spatial awareness than most guys, and Houston does that a lot.
Yeah. Houston comes in three, and the top two, and I thought there was clear separation between the top two and the rest of the list when making this list, and obviously we did too. Khalil Mack comes in second. He got second place votes from you and I, and he got a first place vote from Irwin. He was great as a rookie, even if the stat line didn't say so. And last year, the stat line sort of started to match up with his ability. I mean, he's a superstar. He's a budding superstar, if he isn't already a superstar right now.
He moves as well left and right as any player in the NFL at his position. In fact, he's the best at his position, but you could argue just as a lateral mover, he's as good as anyone in the league other than the top running backs. So I love him. I think I get what Irwin's saying with him. I think Mack has a more steadier down-to-down impact than Von Miller does. Von Miller's, his big plays have just been so dynamic, and we saw it most in the Super Bowl, of course. You just can't overlook that anymore, especially at a position that's kind of a home run hitting position like edge rusher is or edge player would be. But Mack is the, if we're just going how many plays do you positively impact, Mack is the best edge player in the NFL for number of plays. He's in the action a lot.
Well, there you go. And then number one, as we mentioned, the newly paid Von Miller. First place votes from you and I. Second place vote from Irwin. Miller, in case you missed the news, gets his deal from the Broncos. 6 years, $114.5 million. $70 million of that is guaranteed. Only Andrew Luck got more guaranteed money. And reigning Super Bowl MVP. Miller, his ability to, I guess you'd say, bend the edge, sort of basically turning and yet staying at top speed, is pretty much superhuman.
Yeah, the change of direction is perfect. It's perfect. It's what you want.
I mean, is there any chance? We talked about this with some of the veterans on the list. Obviously, Miller at some point, it might not be soon, but 5, 6, 7 years down the line, he's going to slow down athletically. He's going to diminish a little bit his natural athleticism. Is he a guy, in terms of what you see from instincts and, I don't know if you'd call it football IQ, is he a guy who will last long once those tools start to fade?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it at this point. He's 27, so he's got at least 3 full superstar years left in him, you have to think. That's a really good question. If I had to guess, I'd say yes. He'll last okay. He'll age well. Mm-hmm. But I haven't thought about that enough to give it a good answer.
All right. Fair enough. Well, he was a guy the Broncos absolutely had to have back this year, especially since they are going to run out a quarterback who's probably not very good, Mark Sanchez, or Kalen Kaler's favorite Northwestern alum, Trevor Siemian. Sounds like the quarterback controversy out in Denver. And if that's your options, you better bring back your all-world pass rusher. So that was it. That was our countdown of edge rushers. We have one show left as far as the position rankings go. That will be quarterbacks, which some of you might be interested in talking about and hearing about. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to Jeff Irwin, our researcher, to Alex Abnos, our producer and editor. You want to get me or Andy? We're out there on the social media, Facebook, Twitter. You can also email us at talkback@themmqb.com. But that's going to do it for this week. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit, and this was the MMQB Podcast.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.